This is Brass Tactics, policy and strategy for the people, not the politics.
Good evening, Peter.
Good evening, Joe. How are you tonight?
I'm pretty good, considering I remembered what our topic was going to be tonight, and you seem to have forgotten.
Well, I would have taken notes, but...
Welcome to Brass Tactics, and as we said for a very brief window back in the early 2000s, Togorokak Putin. You remember way too much of that.
You triggered a primal memory within me. Yo, rest in peace, Alexei Navalny, by the way, dead today. The only actual opposition figure to Vladimir Putin in the last 15 years.
I get so many questions every time something pseudo-scandalous comes up as a current event. They didn't kill him.
I mean, we don't know that. He could have. I mean, here's the thing. Who do you think poisoned it with Novichok back in, how long ago was he poisoned? 3-4 years ago?
Okay. Hey, no. Time out. I didn't say he's never tried to kill him before. I said they didn't kill him in prison. Because here's what happened.
No. I mean, he probably passed away from complications from that Novichok. That's what I think most likely happened.
I thought the poisoning happened a lot longer ago.
It happened a while ago, but it permanently... I mean, number one, he was in a medically induced coma for weeks, and then he was permanently crippled from it.
Yeah, but he's been locked up for, like, what, a year?
Yeah, about a year.
Yeah. They didn't kill him.
I mean...
The thing with imprisoning somebody is they get forgotten.
The thing with killing somebody is they become a martyr. I agree with you. You're completely correct. But the dude was in... But also the fact that maybe the Putin administration directly led to his death. Would that qualify as killing him?
He perishes in a Siberian gulag? He had to know that that was going to be his inevitable end when he started out on this righteous journey, though, right? Like,
not just that, he came back to Russia. Like, he literally came back to Russia from Germany after being in hospital. He knew they were going to kill him. It's a very Russian thing.
It's in his self-employed job description that, in one way or another, the Russian regime would be ultimately responsible for his demise. But they didn't just decide to Epstein him, is what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, there's no motive to have done that.
They put him away, and they figured he was going to die there. They probably didn't anticipate he'd die so soon. But here's the good news for the Russians, for the Kremlin, is that during the ongoing special military operation, there are laws in place that even further restrict freedom of speech. So this is actually the best time for him to die, because they can crush any protest, but any commemoration of him that happens, and then say, oh, it's anti-war, it's anti-patriotic. So it worked out great. Whether they killed him or not, the timing was very appropriate. And again, in classic Russian fashion, he's a martyr, but without a following, you know? That's what Russians do best. You get martyrs, but no movements.
Well, I don't know, because normally I'd agree with all of that, but this seems inconveniently close to, frankly, the most masterful piece of just enough sincerity to give me pause and think that it was not a very deliberately targeted media spiel with this Tucker Carlson interview.
Who was sincerity on the part of whom? Putin, Carlson, both?
On Putin. I was with him up until, we'll get into it a little bit, but up until he was like, well, then I don't have any clue why Lenin decided to give Ukraine extra territory when he declared them to be a sovereign state within the USSR.
I mean, not so much Lenin giving them extra territory. Stalin is the one who gives them like an extra 500 kilometers of Polish land.
He said Lenin. He said Lenin when he redrew the map. But that's what he's saying. Like Ukraine was a, he was saying Ukraine was like a Polish subsidiary or whatever, press minority, blah, blah, blah. But then the part that broke the illusion for me was his choice to say, and I don't know why Lenin would have done that. I'm like, all right, so now we're gaslighting.
Because that was right before.
Objectively speaking, if Lenin gave it to them, then that was the head of the Russian state acknowledging the sovereign boundaries of Ukraine.
Not
regardless of how Putin feels about it. That's what would have happened. It's just an acknowledgement, like, you have this land. Like, France done messed up when they sold us Louisiana and then the majority of North America to TJ for $5. Deal's a deal, right? Lenin's like, here's the new Ukraine under the USSR, rah rah. So at best, that makes what Putin's war effort right now, he's calling take-backsies.
It didn't bother you at all how he opened up the first 15 minutes of his history lecture talking about the Kievan Rusi, but then never mentioned at all why Moscow was founded and then how Moscow inherits Kiev, because he makes it like Kiev is like the heart of the... He does, he mentioned Moscow, but he doesn't kind of talk about how all of a sudden Moscow becomes the center of Russian culture and civilization. What took you by surprise the most, Joe?
From everything, from the way that President Putin presents himself to the weaving in the invitations to fact check with people still living, it was just a very masterfully laid out interview. And my only other side note while Pete's falling asleep is that I don't get why everybody's calling Tucker Carlson a traitor, if I'm honest. Like, he's a journalist, right? He's interviewing another guy. Like, how else are you supposed to learn stuff? How to learn if not talk?
I don't see that either. He's engaging with another side. I don't see him doing the
people are just mad he's being a better journalist than the rest of them. Is that the Hanoi Hotel reference?
Hannah, or whatever. Hanoi chain, sorry. Hannah, my goodness.
Hannah Montana?
Jane Fonda was infamous. No, Jane Fonda, the famous actress in the 1960s and 70s, was infamously photographed while visiting North Vietnam, including, I think she, like, sat behind an air defense emplacement, you know, that had been used to shoot at the American bombers. That was more of a peace thing, like, with peace at all costs, you know, hippies. This is different. I think Tucker's main intent when he went over there was to kind of just calm Americans down. I believe that Tucker's main intent was not to actually, you know, I don't know what his intent was, but I think his main concern, let's say what his concern is, but because he's vocalized that repeatedly, is that Americans are getting way too agitated over this war in Eastern Europe. That is a war that it threatens the existential existence of the United States. So he's trying to point out, I believe, that it does not, and that basically Ukraine could catastrophically collapse and the Russians could march all the way to the border with Poland and there would not be a substantial shakeup of the United States as a polity because we're isolated geographically.
But it does, though.
It does, though.
I'm not sure I agree with that statement, Pete, but if you are a boomer and you have been involved in the foreign policy community since before the fall of the USSR, then you may have a hard time seeing how Russia invading Ukraine is an existential threat to the United States. Going all the way back to half of our first episode, right? The bastion of freedom and democracy versus the forces of authoritarianism.
Yeah, that's fine. So regardless, though, we're not at... This is the weird thing about this war. We're not at war with Russia. We're not declared war against Russia. If we would be, this war would be proceeding very, very differently. We're acting in a weird way, kind of like...
Yeah, you call the state of Russia out, Pete.
No, I'm just pointing out that the war...
Yeah, Russia, you don't want us getting up in there.
No, the war would be proceeding differently. That's literally all I said.
Hold my earrings.
Going differently. I did not say it would be over already. I said it would be proceeding differently. I'm saying what this looks like instead is much closer to the Spanish Civil War of 1936, where you have 1936, 1938. You have, or even 39, I think it was, whatever. Andrew will correct me on that. What you have is a plethora of actors from either side of the world supporting a side in what is essentially a civil conflict. You have a war between two Soviet successor states, the Ukrainian SSR and the Russian Federation. And the Ukrainians are backed by the West and Japan and a few others. And Russia is backed by North Korea, China, Iran. But none of those countries are at war with each other. The only countries at war are Russia and Ukraine. However, materiel, money, and volunteers are pouring into this conflict from across the world from both sides. It's also becoming a testbed for new technologies, which is an interesting also parallel to the Spanish Civil War. If this can, I think we want to do an episode on this, by the way, Joe, because I've been to two European conferences over the past year, and both of them are asserting that we're living in a new interwar period. They're starting to see the similarities between today and the 1930s as it was. And the Ukraine War, the Russo-Ukraine War, would fit kind of nicely in that paradigm. But I'm not, apparently. No. Okay.
I strongly disagree on the grounds that it's, I don't think it's a new interwar period, because, I mean, it's not that I don't believe the famous fiction writer Samuel Clemens when he says history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. But the problem is, before computers, like, you're going to have me looking like a hypocrite on this one, Pete, because I just spent a couple episodes ago railing about how computers ended the pursuit of higher understanding of the phenomenon of warfare. But before computers and before the hard sciences, the way everybody tried to learn about warfare was saying, oh, this is just like this other thing that happened. And you had this analogous estimating phenomenon happening where every war was presumed to be the next war, and it fell into a pattern of, oh, we are always constantly surprised when somebody innovates.
Yes, but here we are.
And so drawing any parallels like that to refer to it as a new interwar period, strongly implying that there will be another war that looked exactly like the previous World War II, it's a categorical assumption that is probably not going to prove valid in the end, because frankly, the world is not all against any one state right now, and it's not for any one state, and there are large swaths of the world that are just not even involved in foreign politics, that were not even in existence during the last interwar period.
That was the case during the 1930s, too. The vast majority of people just wanted to be left out of it, and it was kind of up for grabs who was going to be in which camp.
A lot of recognized states wanted to be up and left out of it, but there was a whole continent of other states that weren't even involved. And that whole continent is about to be, demographically speaking, in the next 20 years, the highest population center of gravity on the map. And then you had other states that got involved simply because it was working out for them, like India. And so it's just the world is not the same as it was, but I could see how European counterparts would say that, because there is generational memory in Europe, and the last World War did focus on Europe. I don't think the next World War is going to focus on Europe.
It's also politically expedient for the Europeans, especially those in the military, because saying this is just like the early 1930s is kind of like a little prick. It's a spur to their governments to actually try to give them some money, because they haven't had money for the last 40 plus years.
So there you go. We already, found an ulterior motive without even having to look that hard.
Of course there's an ulterior motive.
I take strong exception to grandiose labelings, as I usually do. I don't really believe in labels.
It's a lot more exciting that way, though, isn't it? Thinking we're on the precipice of another third world war.
Weaponizing rhetoric, exactly how
Russians do it. Oh, fantastic segue.
So, Pete, the rest of this, because I know you are fairly well informed about this interesting, fascinating part of Europe. I'm not. Can you walk us through Putin's version of Russian history?
Of course.
Especially like before he starts demonizing the Poles, because the language he was using there was a strong indicator that we may have left the objective record keeping.
So he starts out and he doesn't tell, like, he does not lie for the first at least 5 or 7 minutes of the whole thing. He's telling us straight up historical facts, that the Ruthenian state, the Rusi, the, So the word Rusi, right, the etymology, he doesn't mention it, but it's kind of hidden in his speech. The word Rusi comes from the Norse word rowers, or the men who row. And that is grounded in what he says in the very beginning. The Russian state, the Rusian state, is what he should be saying, but whatever. In 1862, the people of Novgorod invite a Viking, a Varangian prince named Rurik, to come from Sweden to become their prince. Now, this Rurik becomes the head of the Rurikid dynasty, and his son, I think Oleg, goes to Kiev and becomes the prince of Kiev, or Knaz, I think is the Russian term for it. It means like grand prince or whatever.
What is Novgorod called now?
No, it's still called Novgorod. It's okay. Veliky Novgorod, old Novgorod. So there's two Novgorods in Russia. There's Veliky and Nizhny. Veliky Novgorod, interesting aside, Veliky Novgorod is a trade city. It's actually also a semi-republic, and it's kind of the heart of what could be a democratic Russia, but then that is utterly annihilated in the early 1500s when Ivan the Terrible, Ivan Grozny, Ivan the Fourth, completely annihilates the city. He sacks it and kills all the rulers and deports most of the population. That's a completely different aside. But the point is, the two chief Rusian cities are Novgorod, Old Novgorod, and Kiev. These are both on the major rivers that feed on from the Baltic Sea down to the Black Sea, because it's the Viking trade routes. It's the Viking trade routes that go from Sweden and the Viking territories down to Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire. That's how the Varangians, or these Rusians, the men that row, end up as the rulers of the Slavs, the local Slavic peoples, in Novgorod and Kiev. So Putin's not wrong. The original heart, and also the Christian heart, because he also mentions in 988, I think, that Vladimir, the great-grandson of Rurik, baptizes the Kievan Rusi and adopts Orthodox Christianity. Not Latin Christianity, not Islam, but Orthodoxy. So then they continue as a fragmented group until the Mongols come. And when the Mongols come, they annihilate everything south of, Tula. So, like, they basically destroy all the Rusi cities south of Tula, and the survivors are forced to flee north. In fact, the Prince of Novgorod, who's a saint in Russia, Alexander Nevsky, he ends up having to swear vassalage to the Mongols. So the Mongols completely put the Rusi under their yoke. And the survivors, again, have to flee to Moscow. Now, this is where Putin starts to go with the reservation, because Putin's whole thesis, in fact, the Russian nationalistic thesis, is that Moscow is the third Rome. Moscow is the true heart of Rusi civilization, not Kiev, not Novgorod, not Ryazan, not any other city. It has to be Moscow, because that's where the Tsars come from. That's where Ivan the Terrible becomes, after conquering Novgorod. It was his dad, Ivan the Third, but either way, the princes of Muscovy conquer the surrounding principalities and become Tsar of all the Rusians, Tsar of all the Russians. Therefore, from Putin's kind of the picture he's painting you, the true heart of Rusi moves from Kiev and migrates up to Moscow due to the Mongol invasions.
Yeah, so what was he saying was inaccurate, that Moscow emerges as the center of a new, stronger, centralized Russia?
So that is not inaccurate yet. He's still telling the truth.
Gotcha. Okay.
But it's to set the stage, because what he's saying next, this is where he starts twisting things. So what he's saying next is, oh, well, because the center of government moved up to Moscow, the true ancient heart of Rusi, one of the old hearts, Kiev, was basically conquered by malign outside influences. First the Mongols, and then later the Roman Catholic Polish Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Can you unpack that one a little bit more? When he starts talking here, he starts talking about Russia, like there was a European Western / Russian Lithuanian entity of Russia that started being deliberately Polonized. Can you like pull these threads apart for us to make it a little bit clearer?
Yeah. So his point is, because he's trying to tell everyone that Ukrainian, quote unquote, the whole point of his entire spiel is that Ukrainians are not a legitimate nation, neither are Belarusians, but Ukrainians are not a legitimate nation because they're just an artificial construct. They've never had a national awakening. They're just deluded Russians who need to come back into the fold. Therefore, he immediately starts fixing blame for who's been leading them astray. First, it's the Mongols who have to destroy everything. Then it's the Poles who come in and bring the taint of Roman Catholicism and the Latin alphabet and all these other horrible ideas. And the Poles start Polonizing the areas around Kiev and Lviv, or Lviv, whatever you want to call it, in Western Ukraine, into something more in line with their commonwealth so that they can enforce control over it. And of course, the Poles are the mortal enemies of the Muscovites. The Poles conquer Russia and conquer Moscow in 1620 and occupy it because Russia is not having a good time.
Is that where he starts talking about Catherine the Great restoring Russia?
Not Catherine, I don't think. So, but well, first he has another point that's very important. Is that this? He claims this is where the term Ukrainian come from. Ukraine means frontier or borderland. So Putin's entire point is that, oh, well, if their name is Borderlander, then they aren't an actual country because clearly they're just on the borderland of something. And he says the Poles are the ones who gave them the name Ukrainians because, oh, they're on the border of our empire and the real Russian empire, which is up in Moscow. And then he moves on to the point like, well, the people in Ukraine, not Ukrainians, but the people in Ukraine, the Cossacks, which Cossack means free man in like, it's like a Turkish loanword, but the Cossacks who live there in Zaporizhzhia along the borders of the Don River, these are kind of free nomadic horsemen. They rebel against the Poles. Now, Putin's point is, oh, well, they rebel against the Poles because they want to be part of Moscow under Bogdan Khmelnytsky. Not particularly. That's remembered differently in Ukraine. He's remembered as a Ukrainian nationalist, right? He's remembered as someone who wants to be independent of the Poles because he doesn't want to pay taxes. The point, though, is that in, I think, 1654, Khmelnytsky applies to the Tsar of Moscow, the Romanov Tsar, and says, protect me against the Poles so that I don't have to pay taxes. And the Tsar comes down and says, absolutely no problem. And at that point, the Ukrainian Cossacks become part of the Russian Empire. They switch. This is happening concurrently with a time in Polish history called the Deluge or Potop, when the Swedes are invading them from the northwest, the Crimean Khanate is up in arms, and the Turks are attacking them from the south. So the entire Polish Commonwealth is disintegrating by 1654. So the Cossacks are part of this. He doesn't say this, by the way. Putin does not mention that Poland is disintegrating by the mid-1700s. But he says, oh, well, no, the Ukrainians really wanted to be part of Russia, so they rebelled against the Poles. It wasn't the fact that the Poles were being extremely weak and the Cossacks saw an opportunity and jumped on with a stronger horse. Got it? So then he moves on to Catherine the Great. Catherine the Great is when he starts saying, well, then Russia reclaimed all its, quote, historical lands in the south and west. Moscow had never ruled that before, ever. But he's saying, oh, well, it belonged to the Kievan Rusi, therefore it must belong to Moscow as the true heir of all the Russian Slavic peoples. Again, the whole point is immediately after that, he says, oh, well, guess who came in afterwards after we partitioned Poland? The Austrians. And what religion are the Austrians? Roman Catholics. So they're bringing the same evil taint in again, and they're corrupting the locals, who should be good, honest, loyal Muscovite citizens. No, they're making them think, oh, no, you're your own independent nationality. You're some kind of Ukrainian. You can't exist like this. You can't have your own national awakening in the 1800s, which he does not mention. That's when the Ukrainian language begins to really become popular, even though it's banned. He does not mention the deliberate Russification of the Ukrainians and Belarusians and the Baltic peoples, where their independent languages were banned. They had to be Eastern Orthodox. Russian Orthodox, to be explicit. They could not publish any kind of literature in their language. They were, you know what I mean? He skips over all of that. But the whole point is, who's the villain? The Poles. Who's the villain? The Poles. And then later, the United Kingdom. Boris Johnson's the one who blows up the peace deal. And then over all of it, the United States. Because the whole thing he's trying to make American audiences think is, oh, the Poles, they're not to be trusted. They're not good people. They collaborated with the Nazis. They did all sorts of bad things because the Poles are the linchpin to American support of any support to Ukraine, because that's the land bridge. They're also the cornerstone or the keystone of Eastern European defense against Russia, because the Poles by far have the largest land force. So if Putin can introduce any kind of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and start peeling the Poles
away. So we get
away,
to the end of World War
away
II,
support for the,
and he starts making all of these
the
claims
from any other
about
country.
How he's Lenin redrew
borders. So it's a very effective historical
Stalin
lecture.
Reaffirms that.
Using history as
Stalin
a weapon.
Includes
very, very good.
The states
in
the USSR as sovereign entities, including parts that were never even Ukrainian, because Lenin made Ukraine the one it is today, very different than this one that he said was existent in 1654 as a satellite of this new Russia. And that's probably the first time me, as someone ignorant of most of Russian history, was like, okay, now I see some baloney here now. Because even then, like, if he's claiming to be in the right of international law, at best he's doing a take-backsies, right? Because previous heads of Russian state have already affirmed this, and all of this was accepted under international treaties and stuff. But you skipped ahead a little bit to start talking about Boris Johnson and these other folks that are involved and are really the reason why this war keeps going on, right? And that's where today's cocktail convo from my end comes in, because I started, I can't say Putin's wrong. The cocktail convo tip is the organizational model of decision making. It's a foreign policy term. I see you chuckling over there, but it's legitimate, because especially when he is talking about the U.S. presidents, it's a well-established fact that U.S. presidents don't have as much authority as they're constitutionally empowered over the executive branch departments.
Yeah.
Most notably the Central Intelligence Agency.
That's precisely his little, that was the precisely the point of his little anecdote about Bill Clinton.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. It's like he is, everything he said there could 100% be credible. And somebody should really ask Mr. Clinton how much of that was factual. Because the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, nobody's checking up on the CIA. The CIA is doing its own thing. Early 2000s, CIA exposed for doing the wrong thing. And I feel like we've moved past that as a society, but what has fundamentally changed about oversight in the executive branch that would indicate that the CIA is not currently still out there doing its own thing? So doing its own thing is pretty much the definition of the organizational model of decision making. It says organizations exist, and much like Newtonian physics, once it's in motion, it does not want to ever stop being in motion. Once you create a new machination, like the CIA, like the Department of Defense, like any other department, it is going to figure out what it's doing, and it's going to keep wanting to do that thing. It will develop its own culture that reinforces its own perceived mission set, not the mission set that you told it to do. And because these are made up of civilians that have permanent jobs rather than made up of duly elected empowered officials that all have a ticking clock on them of 4 to 8 years, they just wait. They drag their feet. If you tell them to do something that they don't find in line with their organizational culture or organizational values, they're going to drag their feet in order to avoid having to do that. And then once you're out of office, then there's a new person who is just going to assume everything that is coming out of that office is the golden truth and is the best possible advice, rather than it potentially being advice that is self-serving to the organization. A less nefarious example is kind of helps describe why the U.S. always uses the military. The military is the biggest executive branch asset that we have. And so it's the most funded and it's the easiest to use because of all of these reasons. But the military is not really good at doing things that are not military related, because when you are a hammer, every problem you have
looks like a nail.
It's not meant to sound accusatory. It's just meant this is how bureaucracy works. This is how these organizations develop. So it's entirely possible, without being able to ask Mr. Clinton myself, it's entirely possible that President Putin did sit down with all of these presidents, and these presidents agreed to terms, and then the president was suddenly countermanded by his own subordinate offices. Because democracy does a lot of things well, but reconciling it itself with temporally elected officials, with permanent evergreen executive branch departments, is not something that any particular democracy has been able to figure out.
Yeah. And to be honest, it also doesn't matter because, again, it just interposes more fear, uncertainty, and doubt. It's like, well, is our executive even in control? Well, we don't know. We're hearing it from somebody else. And that, I think, also is driving to Putin's other main point. It's the fact that we may not feel that we're in an existential threat right now, America, most of us, but Putin and his administration and the majority of Russians do feel like they're in an existential threat. The vast majority of Russians, by the way, because there's no substantial protester or any kind of anti-Putin activity at all, partially due to very efficient Kremlin liquidation of any kind of oppositional figures, Garry Kasparov, Alexei Navalny, etc. But also the fact that as Putin is sitting there in that room in the Kremlin calmly talking with Tucker Carlson, the fact that conservative estimate 150 to 200,000 Russian troops have been killed in action or wounded in action over the past 2 years, just to prove a point. He's proving a point. The fact that the Russian Federation can absorb losses, it can take these sanctions, it can handle any kind of blow that the American Empire and the West attempts to deal at it, and will continue to grind on and grind on, and there'll be no stopping it because we think this is imperative to us. This is a province of vital strategic interest, and nothing will get in between us. I think that was the second main point of the interview, besides sowing kind of, you know, discord amongst the Western allies and other things like that. It was the fact that, like, look, this is very serious.
Doubt and uncertainty.
Yep. Which was very effective. Again, he's an ex-KGB agent, man. Well, not even ex. He's still acts like it. He's very good.
Yeah. Towards the end of the interview, before the appeals to release the espionage specializing journalist, depending on whether you take Tucker's side or Mr. Putin's side, he keeps, first he did it with Lenin Stalin, then he does it with Mr. Gorbachev, right? 1991 USSR collapse, Ukraine takes away all of this historically Rus stuff, and he has no earthly clue why Mr. Gorbachev let them do that. And I just infer he's saying that they made the wrong call, they were unfit mind in order to continue to justify his claims. But then again, the problem is that I keep coming back to is, well, he's not wrong, though, because the next thing he talks about, the 5 NATO expansions since 91. No, nobody put in writing that NATO couldn't expand. But if you are no longer considering the Soviet Union to be a threat because they've asked to join the greater geopolitical community and disbanded and became subordinate states, you're not going to treat them fairly and openly by also disbanding new NATO as a goodwill gesture. Like, that is a valid criticism, is it not? Like, that one would consider that reciprocal action, right? But that doesn't happen. And in fact, more states, some previous USSR states, are even let into NATO.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's be careful, though. It's not just let in. These post-Warsaw Pact states are desperately clawing to get into NATO because of the ill treatment they had received at Russian hands. Again, the Russian point is that, oh, well, it takes a color revolution. No one willingly wants to be anti-Russia. They just are Russia-phobic. Tell that to the entire population of Eastern Europe, right?
Okay, so let me finish this tirade in the vein that Putin presents it first.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're right, there's multiple sides to multiple stories here. But from that Russian perspective, that does paint NATO as the bad guy. NATO did, in fact, do these things, even if it's not for the reasons that are ascribed. Which, again, knowing the nature of certain very specific United States executive branch offices, it's not entirely unlikely that Putin's got at least 80% of the story true here. And then Putin is right. Its foreign policy history is a mess with discoordinated and contradictory actions, especially when it comes to respecting other people's sovereignty. We don't have a good history of backing up our claims that everybody should have the right to self-determination and then not interspersing ourselves. For example, I don't know if you know this or not, Pete. Were we arming the Georgian separatists that he keeps referring to? Because I'd buy that for a dollar. I would. I just don't know if we did.
Again, Georgian separatists, I don't know about arming. We were financially supporting the Georgian state after their, the Rose Revolution in the early 2000s. But the separatist motions in Georgia, in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, are directly aided and abetted by the Russians. Again, it's a classic Soviet line. Like, when you're doing it, it's horrible. When we're doing it, it's freedom fighters, right? So that, no, like, we were financially supporting the pro-Western Georgian regime. Because why wouldn't we, right? Like, why wouldn't we support them? Oh, that's your, that's the next Soviet state. Oh, we can't do that. Oh, no. Like, the Iranians and the Israelis are providing, the Turks and the Israelis are providing tremendous aid to the Azerbaijani, to the Azeris, as they're dunking on Armenia. In fact, they might have another war in a few days. We'll see. Stay tuned. That's not an issue, right? That's not a problem when the Turks and the Israelis do it for the Azeris. But when the West does it for the Georgians, oh no, it's an apocalypse. You know, we can't allow that.
Definitely can't disagree with any of that. It's all about framing, which, again, whatever President Putin wanted to come out of this, he framed his case exceptionally well. And in that framing vein, at the risk of alienating even or beefing with any more of our small listener fan base, Peter, I'm going to blame realism for this one again. I feel like Putin, because I think, like, the way after he gets through the grandiose history of the Russian state, everything else from that is told from a retroactive perspective of justifying Russian foreign policy decisions through the lens of realism. It's like he read Mearsheimer right before going into this interview and made sure to hit all the key bullets.
Wow, it's almost like Mearsheimer gave him the ammo.
He's retroactively applying the realist lens and realist tendencies when, in fact, there's clearly cultural implications to underneath all of these actions. This wasn't about Russian acting for Russians' power, financial, and security interests. This wasn't Russia acting for purely realist tendencies. Did we define realism with Charlie? I can't remember.
We did not define realism with Charlie, nor neorealism, nor structure realism.
Well, I guess.
Nor what is it? What is the other one? Aggressive realism, or whatever that is.
I guess our loyal fan base will have to wait for our next episode after this one. Episode 7/8, Are You for Realism Right Now?
Oh.
Where we're going to discuss realism.
I like it.
Because realism pushes, drives so much of foreign policy in this vicious cycle, right? What came first, foreign policy or realism? And it's hard to tell the things apart because foreign policy, at least from a U.S. perspective, tends to have realist tendencies, but that is not true of every nation state. And Russia is an example, right? So like Pete said, this is an exorbitant drain on the Russian state to a point where Russia would conceivably be hindering their national security interests by how much they're sinking into it. So either they have a lot more than we think they have, or this is just a hill that they're genuinely willing to die on for reasons that we cannot fathom because it doesn't make dollars, so it doesn't make sense.
Or both, to be honest. I think both of your points are completely valid. They have more than we think they have. They can suffer more than we think they can. And this is more important than we think it is.
But yeah, Mearsheimer, let's back this one up, because Mearsheimer writes a very credible, groundbreaking theory that really does move forward our understanding of international relations, even if it's probably not the ideal understanding. But this lens of realism, rather, everything else that we've hinged foreign policy analysis off of, literally writes Putin's justification for him. So he just sits down in this interview and says all of the things that all of these other analysts were expecting from Russia. You kept asking John Wick if he was back. Yeah, I'm thinking he's back.
But boy, does that make the freaking, like, is this now a self-fulfilling prophecy of the realists, of the old Cold Warriors?
Honestly.
Why does everyone keep saying new Cold War? Why does it have to be a new Cold War? Why can't it just be a geopolitical conflict, right? Why does it always have to be couched in this? It's, yeah.
Because the supreme irony, it's not even new, though.
Yeah.
New implies that actors changed, right?
Yeah.
Or that something changed. Fundamentally, we're still stuck in a cold. We're still stuck in the Cold War mindset.
So therefore, the war never ended. In the words of Ferdinand Foch in 1919, like, this isn't a peace; it's an armistice for 20 years. The Cold War never ended. Just like there are no two world wars, there's just one giant world war from 1914 to 1945.
And again, going back to what President Putin says, I don't think he's wrong. I think there are fundamental elements of our bureaucracy and of our political administrative structure and of our governance overall that never really accepted that the Cold War ended. I, being born in 92 myself, I can't really fathom growing up in that shadow and having that just baked into your daily life. And so that is going to be a cultural tenet that is very hard to let go.
A generational tenet. We also have to think, what about Putin? He's born in the same time period as all these other people back in Washington. When was he born? 70?
I don't know.
60? I think he was born in 60, right? Around the 60s. Is
it... I got distracted again because I was just thinking how ironic it is that realism is being hoisted on its own petard by President Putin right now. He is employing their theories of the use of hard power against other states for your own national security objectives. In a very, very sharp and pointed, soft-powered public diplomatic way by using it in this interview in a very targeted way.
Well, that's a really good question to have for a certain realist theorist if you were ever to, you know, have an opportunity to ask him.
Now, because like talking with your brother Andrew, right? If I don't talk to them, then I can't be wrong. It's a Schrodinger's cat of Joe's way of looking at the world, right?
It's one way to sustain your ego. I try to follow that myself.
Wow. I mean, I think that wraps this up pretty cleanly.
Pretty good. Yeah, I don't want to go any further. I think it was great.
I do just want to reiterate that Putin's interpretation of history and current events is exactly that. And that we do not condone what he is saying, but we also can't in good conscience tell people to reject what he said out of hand, because that is the beauty of this very well-crafted, like, verbal, non-verbal cues. Everything was constructed with based around a fairly dense kernel of truth.
From all indications, the Russians are going to continue this war until their strategic objectives are met, and they've made those very clear. So then the ball's in the West court. So in that case, the interview wasn't as spectacular.
So the realists, and again, he's using realist logic, which the realists out there are actually have advocated, not all of them, but some have actually advocated that you should cede to these Russian claims.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, shoot, Mearsheimer did it. Like, a couple of months before the war started?
I thought it was, like, right after the war started.
I'd have been right after. Shoot, I don't remember. But either way, he was like, this is unwinnable. Just give it to him.
All right. Yeah. Good night.
Night.